good to see, well, quite a number of new faces, at least new to me. So we're aware that this week we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of our Tri Ratna Buddhist community. I nearly said it in Hindi, Tri Ratna Bauda Mahasangha. Nobody here was here at that time. Dhammadina and I were almost there. I first came along in 1969, 2 years later. I think she was well after me, about 2 weeks. And of course, when we first came along, it seemed as if this movement had been here forever. And it was just a tiny little basement, which is the ancestor of this particular place. A really small basement, Monmouth Street in central London. A long time ago. I'm not going to reminisce too much. It's the curse of old age, isn't it? So what I want to talk about more is the inspiration that lay behind the creation of this movement 50 years ago. And what has been for me the dominating force in my life, the dominating inspiration in my life. So I'm talking about something that affects everybody, but I'm talking about it also from the point of view of what has driven me in my life for 50 years, 48 years, to be absolutely accurate, although in a way it preceded that. Of course, we can begin to understand what that force is only really by going back 2,500 years, 2,560 years, whatever it is, to the Buddha's own enlightenment. I'm sure everybody knows the story and knows it very well. The Buddha to be, we don't really know the full circumstances, but became dissatisfied with worldly life, felt that all the things that he was pursuing were meaningless. He said famously that, why should I, being subject to birth, aging, death, why should I, being subject to conditions, chase after what is subject to conditions? If I, being of that nature, seek something that is also of that nature, it cannot grant me satisfaction. He didn't actually say that. That's my parsing of it. So why don't I, he did say this in translation of the Pali, why do not I, being myself conditioned, chase after or seek after that which is unconditioned, that which is free from birth, aging and death, and so on. So he seemed to have a sort of tremendous existential crisis, which drove him away from his home, his family, drove him in the time-honoured way in India into the jungle, drove him to practice various austerities to seek teachers, and becoming disillusioned with the path of austerity, realising that that way lay only, well, death, and finding that the teachers only took him so far and left the deepest issues untouched, he realised he had to rely entirely on his own resources, and he came to Uruvela. It's a sandy place, it translates as something like that, in modern Bihar, in left-hand side of India, eastern India, and sat underneath a peepal tree, a ficus religiosa, a Bodhi tree, and there gained enlightenment. Woke up. I go there very often. I go there every year. I spend a month there each year. And even now, there's a very, very powerful presence, a very powerful sense of what he achieved. It's almost unbelievable when you're there. You know, you gaze at the spot, which we're pretty sure is where he sat, and under a descendant of the tree that he sat under, and that is fairly historically attestable. You can sit there and just gaze at the spot where this extraordinary event in human history took place, where for the first time, at least from our Buddhist point of view, a new kind of consciousness emerged or was discovered, was realized, or a new way of being conscious was entered upon. And when you're at Bodh Gaya, I always try to sit as close as I can to that spot in the magical belief that the closer you are, the more likely I am to pick it up. And oddly, it does sort of work. Sometimes I sit with my nose against the railing, just peering in at the slab which marks the spot, the Ashokan slab, put there a couple of hundred years afterwards, where apparently he sat. And just sort of face the enormity of what took place, the extraordinary majesty of what took place. And I certainly myself experience a very strong sense of what he did achieve, what he did experience. I experience in a distant way, imaginatively perhaps, but perhaps more than imaginatively, a sort of connection with him or with that state that he entered upon, this new kind of consciousness, this Bodhi. Bodhi comes from a root that is connected with coming round from a swoon. If you know you're unconscious and you come round, that's a sort of distant metaphor for what happens to the Buddha, that he's woken up from the dream that we spend our days in, and sees for the first time clearly, comes round from madness is another way of seeing it, is enlightened. I like the phrase enlightened, even though it's not really a translation of Bodhi, but it suggests the flooding in of light. You know, forget the 18th century references. It's not an intellectual enlightenment as the European enlightenment was. It was a completely new kind of consciousness. And it's that consciousness that, I was going to say indirectly, in a sense, it's directly lies behind the foundation of our movement 50 years ago and behind this particular centre. In a way, it's indirect because, of course, the Buddha isn't here, wasn't there 50 years ago, but in a sense, it's quite direct. I remember myself first encountering the Buddha, first really encountering the Buddha. I actually had previous sort of connections with Buddhism because my father, who's in the British Navy, sailed to the Far East and came back with stories of one of his admirals who'd gone to a Burmese monastery and learned to separate his body from his mind, which I thought was a fascinating possibility. That first sort of triggered my interest. But when I was a student here in London, I found my way to Buddhism because I'd rejected Christianity a long time before, and I read in all the range of world religions, going right to the source material, most of which I could make absolutely nothing of. But when I read some stories from the Pali Canon, direct translations from the Pali Canon about the Buddha, it wasn't just that I felt, yes, this is the religion for me, this is the man for me. It was actually I felt a connection with the Buddha. I felt as if I was in his presence. I was experiencing his influence. You know, maybe an analogy for that would be reading a good novel, where you you know, just been dipping into War and Peace, and you know, for instance, Pierre, who's a wonderful character. He's so naive and fresh and innocent. And when you start reading Tolstoy's account of Pierre, you feel you sort of know him. You come into a relationship with him. So a great novelist, I think, shares a consciousness through the figures of his or her creation. So there's a distant analogy again with the kind of connection that I felt, and I'm sure many others will have felt, with the Buddha when you first begin to find out about him. You feel not a theoretical a sort of description of him or a description of his teachings, for me at least, it was a definite sense of what he was like. A sense that what he was like was completely beyond my ability to understand what he was like, but even that is some understanding of what he's like. Some sense that I was in contact with a consciousness far greater than my own that was mainly distinguished from mine by what it wasn't, if you see what I mean. And again, that's a very strong sense you get, I get at Bodh Gaya, sitting there, my nose against the railing, of a consciousness that's unimaginably greater than mine, unimaginably clearer, purer than mine, which sort of exposing all my ridiculous self-preoccupation in a thoroughly humiliating way, but in a way that is not at all downheartening, if you see what I mean. So it's this consciousness that really lies behind the whole Buddhist movement, this consciousness, this bodhi, that is not merely understood as a story about somebody in the past, but as something that is effective in some way, in some mysterious way, in the present. And that if you do really begin to imaginatively connect with the Buddha through his teaching, through stories about him, through his disciples, his living disciples, and especially his great disciples, you begin to feel that you have some connection with this consciousness that goes beyond space and time. In other words, that's what I'm really getting at, isn't it? That it's not just located within space and time. And of course, it's not really the Buddha's consciousness. It's not to do with one particular space and time. It's a consciousness and awareness that is always at least potentially present, and that when we rise up to it, we can connect with it. So it's that consciousness that lies behind this order and movement, that lies behind this centre, that this centre is about, that this Tri Ratna Buddhist community is about. It's about trying to allow that consciousness to express itself fully in the present, and that we are trying individually and collectively to manifest within ourselves, through ourselves, you could say. So we can never, ever forget that consciousness. We can never reduce the whole thing to teachings, to practices, this way, that way. There are so many ways, so many institutions, organizations. In the end, what validates it all, what makes it all important, what supports it all, what drives it all, what it's all driven towards, is this bodhi, this bodhicitta, even. This citta means mind, bodhi means awakening, this mind of awakened mind in the first place. Which later Buddhism came to understand not merely as a word for the consciousness that the Buddha realized, but as a word for that consciousness as a sort of living force that one could connect with in oneself. So let me say a little bit more about that consciousness and a little bit more about the connection, because that's significant, that's important. As I've said, that the consciousness is distinguished, at least from most of us, absolutely by one major factor. That major factor is that consciousness, that bodhicitta, is without selfishness, without self-reference. It doesn't curl back upon itself all the time, as our consciousnesses do. You know, I'm a fairly experienced speaker, and I don't get particularly high on giving talks, and I'm no longer that bothered about what you all think. I'm joking. But you know, I don't. I'm experienced enough to not be particularly nervous. I'm not nervous at all, actually, and to rather enjoy it. But you know, subtly at the back of my mind, I'm hoping that you're all going to think I'm absolutely wonderful and brilliant. Just subtly at the back of it all, sometimes not so subtly, and you know, to be sensitive to that small frown on somebody's face as they're thinking of something they forgot, but I think it might be to do with me, or some thinking of looking at the delight on somebody's face and not realizing it's what they're thinking about their supper and thinking it's to do with me. So I'm subtly, you know, I hope reasonably under control, steady, sort of referring what's going on right now back to me. And dear audience, please don't be insulted. I think each and every one of you is probably doing something a little bit similar in one way or another. We're subtly self-referential, sometimes grossly self-referential, sometimes crudely, furiously, loudly self-referential. But it's all coming back to me, I. And, you know, it needn't be a bad thing. You can handle that well. I think I'm doing fairly well right now. I'm keeping it under control and I'm trying to remember you're there and try to say something that's useful to you, connect with you. So, you know, that it's not that it's, you know, the devil and so forth. It's not that this self-reference is essentially bad. It's just a fact. It's the way things are. It's the way we're born. As soon as you open your eyes, you parsing the world in terms of I and not I, and identifying with the I dimension of it. It's quite natural and normal. And, you know, our process of maturing, even as ordinary citizens, is to try to handle that well, call ethics, to be sensitive to others and the I in them. What I need to do is realise that I'm not just here for me, you're also here for you, and I have to try to interact with that, if you see what I mean. Try to make sure that I'm not just talking for myself, I'm talking for you, to you. So, yes, so that this self-reference shouldn't be seen as something, you know, to be sort of condemned and burned in the deepest pit of hell, as it were. It's a fact, and we can handle it well, we can handle it badly. We need to learn to recognise it and handle it well. But however well we handle it, in the end, it brings us a measure of suffering on one level or another. Our self-reference inevitably brings us up against reality, because unfortunately, reality is not arranged around me. You've noticed this. It is not arranged for my convenience. In fact, it often seems to be arranged for my inconvenience. And ultimately, it's desperately inconvenient because it removes you from the scene. So the fact that you're self-referential eventually brings you up against the fact of things, that everything's impermanent, that the self is not an ultimate, it's a constructed, conditioned phenomenon that is ever-changing, and that clinging to anything that you think will bring you satisfaction is inevitably going to bring suffering. So from the Buddhist point of view, and actually from our own ordinary, straightforward self-interest, this interest in self is counterproductive. And what the Buddha did was find a way of being conscious. He awakened to a way of being conscious that didn't circle round I. Of course, you know, the Buddha, as he himself said, could say, please pass me the biscuits. You know, he could refer to I in an operational sense. He could say, I came here, I did this. He wasn't, you know, they're not incapable of interaction with others at the level of ordinary conventional speech. But for him, it was a convention, merely a conventional term. A bit like everything, actually, is a conventional term in the end. There are no tables and chairs. They're all mental. They're labels that we put on things for our convenience. But the Buddha was able to act operationally with the concept of I, but knew it was but a concept, did not refer to anything fixed and ultimate, and that therefore consciousness could be freed from that circling round I. That's the essence of it in terms that are most touching to us. The key distinction between Bodhi and Bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, the awakened mind, and our ordinary mind, is that it does not circle around I, does not come back to I. According to the Buddha's own experience, an account of his experience, this gave most immediately enormous release. The Buddha is said to have spent 7 weeks at Bodh Gaya, what we now call Bodh Gaya, in the vicinity of the tree under which he awakened. And again and again in the scriptural references we've got, it describes him as sitting under this tree or that tree, experiencing the bliss of release. Release from the tyranny of I. That release from the tyranny of I is described as blissful. So one of the most important characteristics of the awakening of bodhicitta is that it is blissful. You're no longer tyrannized by the needs of self. Of course, the Buddha is also experiences complete clarity of mind, because our minds are obscured, they become ignorant, we don't see things properly, because I intercedes. So I interpret this situation through my construction of myself and my particular conditioned identity, if you see what I mean. So I'm looking at the scene from my spectacles, the spectacles of my sense of myself, which is very particular. It's going to be different to everybody else's, white, English, male, etc. That's all, you know, a certain age, not going to tell you what it is, that all conditions the way I look at things. That obscures things to me. You know, you get these horrible moments where you realise that you've been looking at the world in a certain way and acting on the basis of those assumptions, and you suddenly realise it's not actually like that. It's just the way you've sort of been conditioned, or, well, you conditioned yourself in a certain sense, to see things. So when you drop the circling back on self, on selfishness, everything comes clear. You see things as they are. And it's not, you know, an intellectual knowledge, of course. It's not something to be learned from a book or whatever. It's just to be seen. I do a meditation practice on the Bodhisattva of Wisdom. His mind is said to be purifying like a cloud-free sun. So the clouds are drawn away, the sun just shines. It's not a sort of, you know, special mirrors and lenses and things like that that focus it so that it's wise. Just take away the clouds of self-clinging, clouds of clinging to a particular conditioned identity, and you see. That's why I think the image of enlightenment is so good. The light just shines. And what is, is. So the Buddha is, to quote a famous phrase, that the doors of perception are cleansed. Blake's phrase, isn't it? You stop, well, in Blake's expression, looking, I get this the wrong way around, not looking with the eyes, but through the eyes. So you realise that the eyes themselves are constructing. Do you see what I mean? Anyway, we won't labour that point. So you just see. You just see what is. And the other, the key feature, and the one that I think we're maybe going to focus on a little bit during these days, let's see, is that with the dropping of the attachment to self and the clear understanding of the way things really are, there's no separation between you and others. There's no sense of competition, of comparison, of like and dislike, distinction of who's in and who's out, who's in my group, who's not in my group, who's nice, who's nasty. It just goes, and you just feel a great sense of love, Maitri, for all that lives. Again, in Tolstoyan mood, anybody remembers, I've just seen the BBC film as well, which is very good. It's not Tolstoy, but it's pretty good. But Andrei, Prince Andrei, who's a great pessimist and a nihilist even, and right at the end of his life in the Battle of Borodino, he's dying and severely wounded. And he suddenly experiences an overwhelming love for all around. This is, of course, a centrepiece of Tolstoy's theory of religion, isn't it? That he argued that what was common to all religions was love. And I think that is, in many ways, true. That and this is represented in Buddhism by this overwhelming sense of dropping the identity that makes other identities other, if you see what I mean. Once you stop thinking of I as something different and special, unique, the focus, the centre of the whole world, then you can enter into a joyous delight in the life in others. The nearest I ever come to this is on the London Tube. I find this a very good place for this sort of practice because there's nothing you can do. And there's such a wonderful variety in London these days. It's gorgeous variety of humanity. They're all there. Every kind of flower in the garden of humanity is represented. Every type of personality and so forth. The dark ones, the bright ones, etc., etc. And if you get into a certain mood, I got into this yesterday with Jnanavacha, I'm not blaming him, but you just sort of feel a tremendous sense of unity with everybody, of love and delight in everybody. Maybe the tube doesn't have this effect on everybody, but it's a sort of situation where you're passive and you're present with everybody, if you don't have your mobile or whatever it is with you, everybody else has. But if you just sort of passive and just sort of open up to this wondrous variety of modern London, which is really special, I think, you can get into that Prince Andrei-like sense of oneness, which I think is at least a distant echo of what the Buddha experiences at enlightenment. Because he's dropped his self preoccupation. He's stopped seeing things from a partial particular point of view. Yes, his eyes are open. The same light falls on the same, ocular construction. But his consciousness is free from attachment to one end of that perceptual situation. And that brings about this great sense of understanding, ability to identify with others, seeing people as they actually are, very interesting on the Enlightenment in some of the traditional accounts describes how the Buddha has a number of abhinyas, that special awakenings, special knowledges. And amongst those is seeing beings in their trajectory, as it were, seeing where they've come from and where they're going in terms of life to life, if you see what I mean. He can see, you know, that they've arisen from this world, they're in this one and they're going to that one. So he can see their sort of trajectory, their karmic trajectory. What I think that is the that when you stop separating yourself from others, you see the life in them, the sort of drive in them that's taking them in a certain direction. Maybe not a good one for them, or maybe not good enough for them, maybe even destructive for them. But you can see it to a little extent, just for a moment. You can see where they're going, where they're coming from and where they're going. Maybe not in a life, but you can sort of sense the overall momentum of their life. And this is what I think the Buddha's compassion means. He's able to see what beings are like, where they're going, where they're coming from. And of course, the suffering that's involved in that. That's the big thing, isn't it? That he's not, you know, other people's suffering is terribly inconvenient to us because it distracts from our own desire for happiness. And it sort of either reproaches us or threatens us, to be a little cynical about it. Or it tears us, pulls us down, or it becomes overwhelming. But the Buddha's able to open up to the suffering in all human life, in all life, inherent suffering in all human life, without blocking it, without disguising it, and to, as it were, take it in, and where he can, respond to it creatively, respond to it constructively. Of course, his major response was this. His response was what we're doing right now. It's the Buddha's response to the suffering that he saw around him and to the need that he saw people had for a way out of their suffering that comes from their self-clinging, that he taught a Dharma that we are now trying to practice. So, yes, the Buddha's consciousness, this bodhicitta, that is the basis for the founding of this movement, of this order, that lies behind the centre here, imperfectly. We're struggling to let that spirit manifest itself. We make many mistakes because we are not yet free. But we are inspired by that consciousness, not merely as a thought or an idea, but as something felt, as something that we feel is directly connected to us and that we try to reach up to. This has certainly been the basis for my life over the 40 or more years that I've been a Buddhist. I've tried to, as best I can, and with many failings, to connect with that and to allow it to manifest within me. And collectively, we've tried to do that. We've tried to bring ourselves into relationship to the consciousness that the Buddha brought into the world 2,560 years ago or whatever, and to allow it to manifest through us and to try to bring it into connection with others. That's essentially what this is all about. It's about a sort of spirit or force or consciousness. Consciousness, I sometimes feel, is too static, a kind of metaphorical term. Consciousness, we think of course, it's connected with to know and to know. But it seems like a sort of searchlight, just looking out into the world. But a consciousness is, in Buddhist understanding, citta, is something dynamic, something active, creative, it may be destructive as well. but that is a force. Consciousness is a force which guides and directs our actions, and that forms the world around us. So consciousness, when we're talking about bodhicitta, when we're talking about awakened consciousness, we're talking about a consciousness that is, in a certain sense, a living force, if you see what I mean. I don't mean some sort of Ouija board-like spirit. I mean a sort of, a dimension of awareness that is beyond self-clinging, that is active and effective. So that's what we're here. We're here because the Buddha realized that consciousness, because he tried to share that consciousness with others. He didn't just try, he succeeded. He even succeeded across 2,500 years in communicating it to me, to sharing it with me. And I'm sure that's true of you, if you can think like that. It's not just teachings, it's not just principles, it's a living spirit that we connect with in mysterious ways. I'm going to talk more about how we connect with it and how we work with it starting tomorrow, because Buddhist tradition has a whole set of teachings about connecting with and developing bodhicitta. And under the heading of what's called mind training, which I think is very important that we understand much better and bring into effect, how to connect with that bodhicitta by working on our own direct experience here and now in the situations of life, and especially the difficult situations of life, which this particular set of teachings annoyingly says are the best. The more difficult it is, the better, damn it. Anyway, more of that tomorrow. I'll spare you today. But there's a dimension of the development of bodhicitta that I want to bring out today, preparatory, which I'll come back to later. One of the key feature of bodhicitta, of this consciousness that first emerged in the world through the Buddha, and that has animated the Buddhist tradition down to the present day, and that has effectively founded this order and movement, and has certainly founded this centre. Again, I'm not therefore claiming that it's all perfect and wonderful, but it's behind it all. We got in the way rather than manifesting it fully. I got in the way. But it's there, it is there, it is alive. So while we're sort of thinking about that, it's important to recognise that one of the key ways in which bodhicitta arises is through our interaction with each other. Because when we interact with each other, self comes up against self. Damn it. Anybody who's married knows this very well. Or not even married. You come up against another self. Again, I read another wonderful book. Sorry for my obscure literary references. Arnold Bennett is a late Victorian novelist, early Edwardian novelist, is a bit out of favour now. But I read a wonderful book of his about a marriage called These Twain, if anybody's interested. And it shows the struggle of two people who've fallen in love with great hardships, married. The first two books are all about that. And so you end up thinking, And the third book, goes on where Hollywood stops, as it were. And it talks about these two people realising that the other person is an ego, and with a different interest and will of their own. And through the course of the novel, they come beyond that. That do, to some extent, sort of transcend the reality of human relationships, is that we have to transcend ourselves if we are to really meet, if we're really to be friends, if we're really to work together. We have to go beyond ourselves. And if we're working together, being together, living together, cooperating together, in a context where we understand that self-transcendence is the business, it's more likely to come about. It does happen, I think, just in ordinary human interactions. This bodhicitta, to some degree, at some level, comes about just in ordinary human beings. I've met some really remarkable people who've nothing to do with Buddhism. But they have some flavour of that self-transcendence. But if we're consciously trying to transcend, and we're trying to do it together, we try to work together, to be together, to cooperate together, it will happen, it does happen. You find yourself having to work with people in our wretched order who you really don't like, no names, and, you know, to give them their due, who really don't like you either. But you're part of the same community with the same ideal of going beyond yourself and laying down your self-clinging for the sake of something greater. And so you're sort of forced, resentfully, to face up to your own self-clinging and stop bothering about the other person's. Because we're very good at noticing other people's self-clinging, but it's much more difficult to notice your own. So when you come into a community like the one we've tried to create here, you're entering into an arena where we have some tools, we have some, you know, techniques, technology, as it were, for it. We have some construction, some institutions for it. But most of all, we have a shared ideal of going beyond yourself. It's that shared ideal without which I don't know why I'd remain in the room with you lot. If you see what I mean, joking apart, steady Subhuti down. Through trying to do something together for a high ideal, for the sake of that bodhicitta, for the sake of that consciousness that the Buddha brought into the world, and in that working together to confront your own self-attachment. And it's not straightforward. It's not just a question of, oh, you humble yourself. Some people need to assert themselves more, actually. But to really work out, where that self-clinging really lies and what transcending it means in this situation with these people. That's mostly what this place is about. Probably many of you came to meditate and to maybe learn a bit of Buddhism. Sorry, that's not why what we do here. Well, it is what we do, but it's a front, it's a cover. We do it just to get you in the room and grind you down. Joking apart again. What is the most effective way of developing yourself is interaction with others who care about development, and care about development in this sense of self-transcendence. So really what our whole order, our whole movement is about, internationally, nationally, locally, and so on, is this self-transcendence. That's why we have an international order, for instance. You know, I work 6 months in India. I'll never understand India. They'll never understand me either. I understand a little bit, and just when I think I've got it taped, I realise I don't understand anything. Yeah, you know what I mean? It's just a different culture. So people construct the world in a different way. But I'm forced to confront my Englishness and my particularity of Englishness. I come from a certain class, a certain race, and a certain educational background and so forth. I have to confront that in that sort of interaction. The wonder of England today is that actually it's all here too. They're all coming together here. It's wonderful, I think. So the international order, international movement, means we're forced to be more than our own localized conditioning. And when you get more and more deeply into interaction in trying to create a centre, a living community, an effective teaching programme, just, you know, getting the bills paid and doing a building project, you know, you must have had to overcome so many selves, Maitri Vadri. More to come, I'm sure. But, you know, in engaging in a project like that for a high endeavour, you yourself get in the way. And if you're honest enough and if your friends are frank enough, you realise that you are getting in the way and you have to overcome it. So when we come together in a centre like this, of course you're free not to. Please believe me, you're free not to. You can come and take a little bit of meditation, you can come and do some yoga or learn a little bit about Buddhism. That's fine with us, we think that's a good thing. But if you really want to engage with us, that's what you're engaging with. You're engaging with a living community that is inspired by the bodhicitta and that is attempting to realise the bodhicitta. Our teacher has said that the bodhicitta, this consciousness that the Buddha first brought into the world, this living spirit, this living force that goes beyond self, is most likely to come about with a group of people working very intensively together. Because when you work very intensively together for the sake of a genuine ideals on the basis of ethics and so on and so forth, you're both inspired to go beyond yourself and sort of forced to go beyond yourself. So we try to create a community that allows people to do that at whatever level they want. You can't be forced into it. You're free to come, you're free to come in a little bit, you're free to get out, you're free to come back, and you're free to go all the way if you want to, because it cannot be a compelled involvement, engagement. But we're above all trying to create a community which is based upon the bodhicitta, upon this consciousness that first came into the world when the Buddha gained enlightenment, and that is aiming to bring that about amongst us. That's the real meaning of this place. It sometimes succeeds, it's sometimes a thoroughly ordinary bunch of people getting themselves all twisted up. It's sometimes all sorts of mistakes, it's sometimes all sorts of diversions. But overall, I believe, and it's my job to try and keep an eye on it as president, on the whole, overall, it goes in that direction. Even sometimes the difficulties, the quarrels, the mistakes, are part of the process. They're the means by which you have to face up to yourself. Along the way, I've made huge mistakes. I've been a leader in our order practically from the moment my nappies were removed, perhaps a little bit before. And I've made horrible messes. Because I'm a self, I'm a particular self, attached to myself, and so on. But through the interaction with others, through the working together, through the sometimes confrontation, sometimes difficult challenges, I believe I've matured. It's not for me to say, but I'm sure that I'm a lot better than I was, and I'm not giving any absolute scale. So involvement with a sangha is really this. Sangha is about realizing bodhicitta. The sangha should become, ultimately, the community of bodhisattvas, individuals who are completely based on selflessness. And even though it's not that, and certainly not that all the time, even the effort and the difficulties that arise within the effort are part of the process, if you see what I mean. Which doesn't excuse unskillfulness at all, but it puts it in a larger context. So I hope that at least I've given some flavour of what I'm trying to be talking about, so that tomorrow I can come on to a little bit more hard-edged stuff, how you work with your own mind to develop bodhicitta. We can work together, and I strongly urge everybody who feels some inspiration from the spirit of the bodhicitta, coming from the Buddha originally, if anybody who feels that inspiration, to engage with the community. We offer different ways of engaging. We don't offer enough, we don't offer a versatile enough range, but we're always open to new ways of engaging with people. You know, just to take examples, I know that a number of people volunteer here and help out on the desk and so forth. And I used to meet with them when Maitri Vajri was looking after that area. And people would again and again say they wanted to do that because it gave them an opportunity to engage with the community. And it was obvious from the way they were talking that they had some sense, maybe they wouldn't have known how to express it, of the practice that led to bodhicitta in that. It was a way of giving themselves, of serving, giving up yourself. We have Poetry East, so that you know we can engage with people through poetry in the context of the shrine room, in the context of the Dhamma, with order members interacting with modern poets of quality, and thereby offering another channel. So ideally we'd have infinite numbers of channels, but you know, time and space are always finite, so there's only a limited range of things we can do. But we always want to expand it. So there's ways in which people can come into interaction with the community and participate in this common spirit and work to make that common spirit more and more bodhicitta. For me, a concluding note is that as a young man in the 60s, I won't tell all my drug stories this time. You know, with the collapse of the sort of old consensus about morality, about even what the country was, what the nation was, who it was, and so forth. It was a quite bewildering time, the 60s. I mean, tremendously exciting. Lots and lots of experiment and so forth, and lots of bad things too. But there was a sense of not really knowing where the compass was pointing, and not really knowing what one was living for. And I noticed in myself a strong desire to serve, to find something that I could give myself to that would make my life meaningful. To live for myself is nothing but pain. If you're living for yourself, well, in the end, you're going to be frustrated. In fact, you're going to be frustrated day by day. If you're just living for yourself, it's a frustrating life. I believe some of these investigations of hedonics say that one of the predictors of happiness is that people are working for a cause greater than themselves. To serve something, this is not a very fashionable sort of term, is it? But to serve at least a truly ethical, lofty ideal is a source of great joy and happiness. And it's one of the opportunities that we offer here. Is a chance at your own pace, in your own way, to serve, to give yourself, as we try to do. Of course, in serving you also get, and we're not without our self-interest in it, but we try to serve. And that is the spirit of the bodhisattva, of the bodhicitta. If we try to serve this lofty consciousness and try to realize it within ourselves and try to manifest it in our interactions with each other. And in our interactions with each other, try to let go of our particular self-clinging. We get tremendous satisfaction. Personally, I believe the only real satisfaction there can be in the end. So today I hope introduced you to the notion of bodhicitta in a particular way. It's not usually introduced in this way, but I think it's quite important to bring it back to the Buddha and to locate it with him as coming into the world through him, and then to describe roughly what that means, especially in terms of going beyond self-orientation, then to talk about the way in which our working together in community, I mean in the broadest sense of community, as well as the more specific residential sense of community, is a powerful way of accelerating this self-transcendence. And I've also spoken of the opportunity to serve as both a tremendous source of satisfaction and meaning, and as a way of transcending yourself. Of course, not without vigilance, not without a moral compass firmly in place, but to serve is one of the greatest satisfactions that can be. So I'll leave it there. Tomorrow we'll look at how we work with difficulties. So something to look forward to.